the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Robert Wagner is my guest this week. His autobiography, Pieces of My Heart, A Life, written with Hollywood historian Scott Eyman, is a truly memorable book, and it's really a great pleasure to say, Robert Wagner, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so glad you enjoyed my book, Gary.
I loved it. It was a great book. You know, in your book, you note that Natalie Wood said you were a star before you were an actor.
Yes, yeah, Nat did say that one time, yeah.
And, you know, it seems to me in the early part of your book that being a movie star was your actual ambition. I mean, you didn't go to acting school or work on the stage before going to Hollywood.
No, but after I got started, that's what I did. I worked with so many coaches, and, you know, there were so many people that were available.
That's when you started to sort of take the craft more seriously as acting?
Well, yeah, but when I first started, I went to classes and took vocal lessons and, you know, wanted to learn how it worked, because I had no idea. It was just all so magical to me how it all happened.
You grew up watching movies and loving movies and wanting to be in the movies. You didn't realize that there was so much involved in the craft of acting.
Well, I guess I did. I don't know. I mean, how they make it look so natural and make it look so easy is just was beyond me, you know. And to make it, you know, the actors that I really admire are the ones that make it so simple, you know, and stay within their craft and stay within themselves and not try to, you know, take it over the top. And sometimes that's hard not to do.
Well, one of the things that's always puzzled me is, now you are one of the rare actors who has had success in both film and in television. And, I mean, there are some actors who started on TV and then went to film and never went back to television. But there is lots of great movie actors who came to television without success. I think Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart did sort of lousy television shows. And certain actors like David Janssen or somebody who was so great on TV but never really made it in the movies. But you were able to do both. Do you think there's a different skill for acting on television than in the movies?
Do you know, I've been asked that before, and I've addressed that a bit. But, my conclusion is that I think it's just the part. It's the part that makes you and makes that happen for you. You know, if you get that one great part that can take you there, it's all in the writing and all in the how it comes out, the timing of when the movie is released, and you know, those are big breaks. Those are big ifs to make it happen.
Yeah, and Prince Valiant wasn't the one.
Well, Prince Valiant was an interesting picture for me.
Yeah.
But it was very successful, actually.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the picture that put me spiraled me into another phase of my career.
You had a lot of faith in your the head of the studio of 20th Century Fox, Zanuck.
Yes.
And do you think he made the right decisions for you?
Oh, I do, yes, definitely. I think he made some very, very good decisions on my behalf. And I, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote this book, Gary, is that I had so many mentors and so many people that were in my life that made such a tremendous difference, and I wanted to acknowledge them and also show that how important it is to have a mentor in your life, to have somebody who says, hey, I think you can do this, and I think this would be right for you. And in regards to with Daryl Zanuck, I mean, I would have done anything that he asked me to do, because I admired his taste and his ability, and I thought that he was thinking of only the best for me.
You know, one of the things that's striking about Pieces of My Heart is that it's really honest. I mean, most people will tell you about the people that they like. But they won't tell you about the people that they don't like.
Yes.
But you don't seem to hold back there. You tell us about Vincent Minnelli, who you're not particularly kind to, or Adolf Manju. I'm just thinking of a couple that stuck in my head. Stanley Donen.
Well, Vincent Minnelli, I had great admiration for Vincent Minnelli. I mean, he made some wonderful movies.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a very interesting experience to have worked with him. You know, he really never did direct me. He directed Natalie. He came in and took over for Michael Anderson when we were doing All the Fine Young Cannibals. Yeah. And but Vincent made some very, very nice movies, very good movies. I didn't really know him very well. I just knew him from kind of afar, you know.
Yeah. And I guess also people must ask you about this who've read the book. You say that you would have killed Warren Beatty.
Well, no, I was waiting in the car.
Yeah.
You know, and I was, you know, I think that a lot of men can probably identify with this. I was just so alone and so empty, and Warren had moved in, he was going out with Natalie, and I was trying to get this all back together if it was all possible. And as you know, sometimes you have a chance with two people, but you don't have a chance as much if three people are involved.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't really think I would have ever had the total guts to have gotten out of the car and done anything like that.
You don't think you actually would have killed him?
No, I don't think so, no.
Well, over the years since then, it's probably happened that you've at least seen him on TV if you haven't deliberately gone to a Warren Beatty film. But when you see him now, do you think, oh, God, Warren?
Well, you know, when we see each other now, it's rather after the fact, because, after Natalie died, it kind of brought everybody,
sure, but
back into some kind of perspective that had nothing to do with things like that, you know. And he felt very strongly about Natalie, and he felt her loss too. So, you know,
yeah.
I haven't seen much of him. I don't see him very much. Once in a while, we'll run into each other. But
what about if if you're sitting alone or at the house watching TV and, oh, there he is? Do you have a feeling about that, or no? Forget about it.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's left me. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course, I have a feeling about it. He's a very successful actor. He's very, very good. And a wonderful director, and I don't think you let that go.
Yeah. We're talking with Robert Wagner, and his autobiography, Pieces of My Heart, A Life, has just been published. You know, your book has some tasteful discussions of some of the great women you've known. You know, many of us have admired the beauty of Joan Crawford on screen, but not many of us have seen her naked between their legs. Were you a little reluctant to kiss and tell in your book?
No, I wasn't, because they were all such wonderful experiences, you know? I mean, it wasn't like a kiss and tell book to say, oh, I've been with that lady or this lady or that. I mean, they were all pieces of my heart, you know?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Even though they were, like that situation with Joan Crawford, that was, that was just a one-night situation, you know.
A memorable night, however.
Wow.
Well, she was beautiful, huh?
Oh, she was a wonderful lady, yes. Uh-huh.
So I guess it wasn't unpleasant to go back and remember all those nights.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. It was a very difficult thing to do, to go back into those places and bring those things up, but that wasn't one of them, but there were some difficult times, and Scott Iman, who wrote the book with me,
mm-hmm.
was so helpful, and he took me, he took me on those journeys, and was, very, very, very good about and easy with me, to get me to open up a little bit about them as much as I, as I could at the time, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did it ever feel? Oh, did he ever say to you, "Oh no, we have to have that in"? And you said, "Oh, I don't know if we should have that." Or
no, not really. We did. We had several things in, in the book that we had to edit it out. We were edited down quite
yeah.
a bit.
Yeah. Were you?
Yeah. But it took us 3.5 years, 4 years to write it.
Well, it's a great work. I think you should be very proud of it.
Well, thanks so much. I that's a very big compliment coming from you. I appreciate that so much. You know, I didn't realize that when you write a book, you don't have an audience.
Right.
And you just have your friends who kind of react to it. You don't know what's going to happen with it, and the results of what has happened with this has been just such a just unbelievable to me, some of the reactions I've had to it.
Well, it's wonderful to kind of go on a journey with you and you know, and have you in my head for 12 hours or whatever it was.
Well, thank you so much. That's great. That's music to my ears.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, have you ever felt that your lack of education, formal education, you didn't go to college, you went immediately into acting. Has that ever been a problem for you, or did you ever think about that?
Not really. You know, I felt that I had the greatest education that I could possibly have, because when I was signed to 20th Century Fox at 18 years old, and I was there for 12 years, that was the greatest education that I could have. That was just absolutely wonderful for me, because I was doing what I wanted to do. I was in the movies, and I was with so many wonderful people that were really so extraordinary and so generous to me.
Well, your career really spanned, you know, three eras now, I guess, if we think about it. I mean, you were there in the years of the studio system, then you were there to follow the studio system, and now, I guess, the rise of the producer again. Were you aware that was happening, or did you just sort of go
along?
Well,
yeah, I was aware of it a bit, sure. Surely we were all aware of it. We were all aware of this tremendous change that was taking over.
Yeah.
There were so many elements that were involved in it. You know, the distribution, the theater, owning the theaters. I mean, there were so many things that were involved in it. But I was so fortunate to be signed to 20th Century Fox and have them treat me the way they did, because it was like a family to me, you know, and I needed that. That's what I needed. For me, it was a perfect blend. For some people, maybe it might not have worked out so well, but for me, it was a dream.
And you did get to meet some of the people that we all watched in the films and, you know, thought about and dreamed about. Clark Gable, for instance, and Fred Astaire ended up playing your father. How about some of those guys? I know you talked a bit about Spencer Tracy. The Mountain is one of my favorite films.
Well, it was so thrilling, you can imagine, for a young actor like myself to have a man like Spencer Tracy say, come on, you know, you can be somebody, I want you to be in this film with me. He gave me co-star billing above the title, which changed my whole career. And, you know, to be associated with him, and he was a great talent. And, you know, he was so kind and so wonderful to me. You know, you kind of have a responsibility then about your life when someone like that takes a hold of you, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm now involved still with the John Tracy Clinic, which is Spencer's son, you know, who was born deaf, and they created this clinic, you know, these mothers created this group to try to dispel the thought that if somebody was deaf, they were dumb and they could have no life, and they're functioning today, and of which I'm on the board of directors, and so the circle has kind of all gone around, you know. It's been a great experience for me.
Let me ask you about some of your contemporaries, particularly Rock Hudson. There's a wonderful picture of you and Tony Curtis and Rock Hudson in the book, and you're all hanging on this ladder.
And yeah, I noticed Tony Curtis wrote a book.
Yeah.
And did you read his book?
I haven't read his book.
Oh, it's very good. It's really very good. And he has the same picture in his book. That was a picture that really meant something to all of us, I think.
I wonder about Rock Hudson, you know, when he announced to the world with Elizabeth Taylor at his side that he was gay, and people were very shocked and so forth. Did you know he was gay?
Oh, yes. I think most people knew that Rock was gay, yeah.
Well, you mentioned some of the great women. Did any men ever make passes at you in your golden era?
I beg your pardon? What was that one?
I say, did any of the men ever make passes at you in your...
Yeah, I had a couple of guys make passes at me. But, you know, I was very definite about the fact that I wasn't gay. As a matter of fact, I say in the book that experience with Noel Coward, that was an interesting one that happened, you know?
Yes, tell us again.
Well, no, it's just that he asked me.
Uh-huh.
He said, "Are you gay?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And he said, "Oh, what a pity! what a pity! I'm so sorry."
That's a compliment, then.
Yeah, and you know, and then you know, they in that time, you know, everybody was really, you know, they were buried, because there were no clubs. There were very few gay clubs, and you know, the guys that were were gay would rent houses or go away on weekends and all that kind of stuff. It was a different life, you know, and one that that I wasn't in. But I knew that about rock. Yeah, most people did.
Yeah. Let me ask you about another actor that you mentioned in your book, and who I'm a fan of is Sterling Hayden.
Oh, yes.
He was an interesting guy.
Oh, fabulous man. Fabulous man. He loved, he was a man of the earth, and he was well-read, a good actor, had a lot of strength, a great deal of simplicity, I thought. Do you know, and, you know, when you get a script and you have a part and you realize that it's really, that part can really work, and you know when your moment is, and you know when you have that chance to bring that character to a sense of reality, do you know, it's hard not to push it, you know, to not become an actor and act it. And Sterling, you know, was very much aware of that. I mean, he, you know, if you're intelligent, you know when your highs, where your highs and lows are, and you got that graph in your head of where your performance is going to go in a way, do you know?
Yeah.
And what you want to do is kind of get out of the way of yourself and let that take you, and if it's well written, it can work, you know? And Sterling had this wonderful, wonderful quality, I thought. I mean, I thought his performances had such strength, and he was a, you know, very wonderful sailor. My God, he loved the sea. And
he wrote that giant novel about the sea.
Oh, that was a great novel, The Mariner, yeah.
Yeah. Well, interesting that you say that, because Alexander Mundy and Jonathan Hart have not so much Pete Ryan, but Mundy and
not
Hart.
Not so much what?
Not so much Pete Ryan, but Alexander Mundy and Jonathan Hart. They sort of have a postmodern quality in your portrayal. I mean, they sort of seem self-aware, sort of breaking the fourth wall to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Were you?
Tried to do that.
Yeah.
I'm glad that got through to you.
If that was a sort of a way of connecting with me. Reaching out to me and saying, "Hey," letting me in on the joke of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We try to do that. Do you know?
Yeah.
That's a style of comedy that is really good. But you have to have a partner to be able to do that. And I had a wonderful partner in Stephanie, and we had some great writers there at the beginning of the sequences. You know, at the beginning of the series, we really had some great people writing for us.
Yeah.
And to let them in on it, I think that's. That's a wonderful, wonderful secret, you know, to be able to let the audience in. And if you can do that, they can identify with you, I think, a bit more. Don't you think?
I do. In fact, I also would say that's true of your brief performance in Boston Legal that you did recently.
Oh, yes.
Of course, that's sort of one of the motifs of the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
Since they even, you know, will sometimes even reference, you know, that we're on TV, or maybe we'll get a spinoff or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, oh, well, maybe there's a show in that for you. Your book says maybe you're not interested in manning another show, but I think it'd be wonderful if you did.
Well, you know, it depends. You know, I kind of like being a part of the whole ensemble piece, you know.
Yeah.
And doing 2.5 Men, I love doing that. And
yeah.
I love doing
funny stuff.
Yeah, it was, and I love doing Hope and Faith with the girls. I like that kind of work, you know.
And you know, everybody loves Number 2 in the Austin Powers
picture. Yes, right, baby, right.
Thanks for doing that for us. Well, I want to change the subject for just a minute and ask you about music, because you reference music a lot in your book, and I know you're a fan of Sinatra as well as a friend. You mentioned Billie Holiday, and you mentioned when you play a jazz musician in one of your films. Is music still an important part in your life?
Very much so, yes, it is. And I'm trying to sort of hang on to the traditional stuff.
Yeah.
Which is a little difficult to do because I have 3 daughters,
and they listen to a lot of crap that you
yeah,
can't stand.
Right. You know, so it's a different beat, but it's a good beat, you know. And if the kids are getting a kick out of it, it's okay. But
have you played them, you know, a little Songs for Swingin' Lovers, and said, "Hey, listen, you've got to listen to this"? Or?
Well, I took them to see Frank one of his last performances in Vegas. And,
yeah,
and he was playing for about 350 people. They had never seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
You know, they'd never seen a man stand up in front of an orchestra and sing with a single light on him. You know, they'd been used to events and all that. So it was an interesting thing. I'm glad they had a chance to see him because he was so profoundly fantastic. I mean, nobody was like him.
You know, even at the end, although his performances, you know, weren't not that great at the end, but I remember last time I saw him, and I'm looking around the audience, and I'm thinking, you know, a lot of these people have never seen him before. And so I think, you know, I'm glad they're here. Even in those performances, there would be moments of brilliance.
Did you have a chance to see him quite a few times?
I saw him, you know, maybe a half a dozen times.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got it.
He was great. He was one of my favorites. I never got a chance to see Billie Holiday, though, who apparently you knew.
Yes, Yeah, I was a young kid floating around. I mean, I was always so taken by jazz and by jazz artists because I felt that they knew their instruments so well and they could just go in whatever directions they wanted to and what they felt at that moment. And I thought that was music in the moment for me, you know.
Sinatra and Billie Holiday have, I think, something in common, and they both have a certain stylistic commonality.
Well, yeah, what they did with the lyrics is...
The phrasing,
you know,
all that.
And their instruments, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible.
What, if you don't mind pursuing this a little bit more, what are sort of the eras of Billie Holiday that you respond to the most? Did you like her early stuff, middle stuff, late stuff?
I liked it all.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked the late. I liked the late stuff very much.
Yeah, and the kind of crackly voice stuff.
Yeah, I liked the late stuff. I mean, because I believed her. I believed that she felt the lyrics. You know, I believed that she felt that. I mean, you never heard her the same way twice.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you knew that she was singing in that moment. She was so special. And Ella was very special, too. I knew her.
Ah.
She was...
Fantastic.
You know, I mean, they're just extremely... I mean, what an opportunity, what a blessed person I am to have been able to not only know them, but to be able to feel their music and to be near them when they were creating it. My God, you know, I mean, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, you know. I mean, it's just fascinating to me how my life has gone and the career that I've had. I mean, I've been doing this... Gary, I've been in this now 60 years.
Yeah.
And that's a long time.
Does it feel like 60
years? And I love it. No, it doesn't feel like that at all. It's every day is like a, you know, and every new job is like a new challenge and a new look at life and a new perspective and listening to somebody. And now I got these young kids coming up to me and saying, hey, what was that like? How do you do that? And what's this? What was that? You know, it's very, very interesting.
You're somebody's Spencer Tracy now.
Yeah, I guess so. But I tell you, it's wonderful. I mean, it's been just fabulous for me. And it's been so great for my family. You know, I've had some very good breaks and put them through school, and we've all, you know, we're all very close, and they're each one of them are touched by the business in some way. So
you have grandchildren now also?
Yes, I now have a grandchild.
Congratulations.
My daughter Katie gave me a wonderful grandson, and that's a whole new experience. Boy, that's great.
Do you still ride horses?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I have a few horses left. You know, I was pretty involved in the horse business. I was raising cutting horses, and I had a champion, and I was producing about I had five top line mares, and I was producing about five foals a year, and then. I got a little bit squeezed by the government and a little bit squeezed financially, so I had to step back.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get out of it. I just couldn't follow it anymore. I got into it too big, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it can be very expensive, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, and also, you know, when you start breeding horses, you want to give them every break they can possibly have, you know, because they have this great potential, and you got to give them all of it, you know, so you have to campaign them. And I got in a little bit too deep, but... It was a great ride.
In a cutting horse, you're really looking for a horse that is really aware of what's going on, is really into it.
Oh yeah.
And how do you discover that?
Well, it's you know, they refer to them at times that they're cowie. You know, when you breed them for cutting.
Uh-huh.
So when they're on the ground, we'd put them in a pasture near some young calves, and we'd observe them and watch them how they track them and how they look at them, and you know.
You think that's an innate thing in certain horses?
Oh, it's that's what you breed for.
Yeah. Yeah.
You breed for that. Amazing, isn't it?
Fantastic. Yeah. 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 I have an Arab.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got one left that I bred, and he's in pasture. He's about 28 now. He's in good shape.
Wow. No, that's good. I hope he lives a long life.
Yeah, well, he's had a wonderful life so far.
Do you remember what your very first appearance on television was, by the way?
My first appearance on television? No, do you?
Yeah, I know. I know this.
You do?
Yeah. I was in the Museum of Radio and Television. This is an odd story. I was in the Museum of Radio and Television in New York. And, you know, they sometimes have things on the big screen there, now known as the Paley Center.
Yes, I know. We were there. We went there for one of Jill's pictures.
Yeah.
That she did.
And
with Carol Lindley.
They had a Jackie Gleason show on.
Oh.
And Jackie Gleason said, I want to introduce a young man making his television debut. He's in the audience here. He's the star of Beneath the 12-Mile Reef. Bob Wagner. Bob, stand up and take a bow. Now, I'm watching it. I'm on the big screen there in Manhattan. This is maybe 15 years ago. And the show is over. I walk out of the museum. I walk half a block. I walk right into you.
You ran into me?
Yeah, you're standing in the street. You were walking down the street. And I said, it's very odd that I'm seeing you because I just saw you on your first television appearance. And you said, security or something. No,
you know. No, I didn't.
No, you were very friendly.
Hey, Jill, what was the name of that picture that you did with Carol Lindley that we saw at the Paley Center? Junior Miss. We went to see Junior Miss.
At the Paley Center.
At the Paley Center. They found it. It was done. Jill did it in 1956, I think.
Wow.
And it was the first color musical. Oh, my God, it was unbelievable. Yeah.
Your lovely wife, Jill.
That
Sainz.
Paley Center is terrific, isn't it? That,
it's
they do
great.
Some great work, and they've collected some marvelous pieces, my God.
And a lot of you. You're one of the most prolific television actors in history, I would think. I just recently saw your Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And that's an absolutely wonderful production.
Oh, thanks so much. I love doing that. I love that character, and it was so exciting. You know, Tennessee was there.
Did you do that in London?
Yes, and you know, he and Laurence Olivier started to rewrite it, and that was kind of fascinating to see that because, you know, Tennessee is not a man to want to give up his words very easily. And it all worked, you know, and I thought Natalie was so wonderful as Maggie the cat, and it was really the most exciting period of my theatrical career, I think, was that one, at least one of them for sure.
Well, there's a picture I want to ask you about that I haven't been able to see, and I recently had the writer Donald Spotto on the show here, and
oh, yes.
he couldn't find it either, and he was working on a book about... Audrey Hepburn, and you two had made a television film together, but apparently no one knows where that film is.
Oh, that film's around. It's run quite often on television. They run it on. Yeah, it's been on a couple of times. Bob Papazian produced it, and I love doing that. It was called Love Among Thieves. It's quite a good picture, actually.
You were happy with that.
Yeah, I am very happy with it, and I loved working with her. It was just a joy, you know.
Yeah, I bet. According to his book, he said that she was nervous because you were such a wonderful television actor, and she hadn't done any television, and that you were nervous because she was this great film actress. And
well, I had known her for so long. You know, I knew her when she first came to Hollywood, and I just adored her, and I just always thought she was one of the most wonderful women that I'd ever met, and she was. And we also, I had a place in Switzerland, and she lived in down near Geneva in Morges, and she was just a, you know, the times that we spent together and knowing her personally was very, very exciting, you know.
Just another great legend that's a pal of Robert Wagner's.
Oh, I loved her.
Well, it's really been just a wonderful opportunity to chat with you. You know,
thanks so much. I'm so happy we could do it, and I can't tell you how I appreciate all the things that you said about my book. Coming from you, it means a great deal.
Well, thank you. In your book, you mentioned, I think you were talking about Fred Zinnemann, and you said he was a gentleman because he was nice to people he didn't have to be nice to. So thank you for being a gentleman today and being here with us on From the Bookshelf.
I love that I ran into you after you saw my first appearance. Security. did very funny.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf, movie star Robert Wagner. How about that? I'll be back again next week with another great program. I hope you'll join me then. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.